This is the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. This show examines the latest legal topics and news facing families whose loved ones have been injured in a nursing home. It is hosted by lawyers Rob Schenck and Will Smith of Schenck Smith LLC, a personal injury law firm based in Atlanta, Georgia. Welcome to the show. Hello out there and welcome to the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. My name is Rob Schenck.
And I'm Will Smith.
And we are Georgia Nursing Home Abuse and Neglect Trial Lawyers, and we happen to be your co-hosts for the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast, so welcome, welcome. A lot of cool, funky, radical stuff to talk about on the podcast today. I don't know why. I think it was because we were talking about Kenny Chesney before we started recording this.
We were talking about the progression of country music from the Carter family, Hank Williams Sr., to Johnny Cash and Merle Haggard, to Alan Jackson, to Kenny Chesney, all the way to Jason
Aberdeen? Katniss Aberdeen.
Like, just horrible stuff.
Yeah, and I don't even know where we spiraled from that. But anyway, I'm glad that we just told you that, because it's extremely important. But anyway, lots of good things to talk about today. Today we are going to be talking about basically the anatomy of a nursing home abuse or a nursing home neglect lawsuit filed in the state of Georgia. So the kind of the nuts and bolts of what a family can expect if they've retained an attorney. The attorney has said, I think there's a case here and I think that we can go to verdict, and the case is filed and goes all the way to trial. What is involved in that, how long it takes, you know, what are some of the costs, both in time and in money, throughout that process. So I think basically we'll skip forward to the investigation process, and we'll just go ahead and say that in our hypothetical moving forward in the timeline that the attorney has assessed that there's a case, the attorney has gotten all the information they need to file, and they're on the deadline and or ahead of the statute of limitations, and everything is good with that. What will happen with the opening salvo, Will, is the complaint for damages. In every civil action, you have to actually have a piece of paper that lays out the allegations and makes a particular claim against a defendant in a nursing home case.
You know what? Let's make a little clarification here, because when you and I say lawsuit, it is different, I think, than what non-attorneys may consider a lawsuit. We don't mean claim. We mean we have actually gone to the clerk of court. It is usually state court, but the clerk of court, we have taken a complaint and they have filed it into the system. They have stamped it. We have paid whatever, you know, the $250 that you owe, and there is a legitimate lawsuit with an actual case number.
That's right.
And the reason that I point that out is that I know that I misuse that term sometimes when I'm talking with clients, just based on their perspective of it. Before we file a lawsuit, a lot of times we'll send a demand letter and we'll get all the evidence ready and we'll put it in the demand letter. And a lot of clients will tend to end up still talking about the case as a lawsuit, but it's not actually a lawsuit until the clerk of court takes your piece of paper and stamps it.
That's actually, it's a very good point. So from a 40,000 foot view, whenever you hear the word claim, it's usually associated with an insurance claim. So like if you've been involved in a motor vehicle accident or something like that, and the ultimate conclusion of that is a settlement with the insurance company for money that will compensate you. That's the ultimate goal of filing an insurance claim. And oftentimes, nursing home abuse cases start off in that way because nursing homes are often insured. Almost always insured by some type of liability coverage. And so the attorney will often send a demand and hope in that claim, that insurance claim, to get compensation from the insurance company. So the ultimate resolution for an insurance claim is to get money from the insurance provider in exchange for a release or the promise not to sue based on that injury. So the ultimate goal of a claim is to get money. The ultimate goal to get money with the injured person and the nursing home as the arbitrators or the final say in how that gets done, the overall point of the lawsuit in which we've gone to the clerks, filed the piece of paper, is that a jury of your peers will determine whether or not you are or your loved one is entitled to money for the injury. That's the ultimate goal of the lawsuit, is to have a jury hear your allegations and say yay or nay to awarding you a compensation. So the logistics of a lawsuit begins, like I said, with the complaint. It gets a piece of paper that lays out the allegations. Miss Johnson was not turned regularly and therefore developed bed sores. The nursing home was responsible for the money it took to cure Miss Johnson of the bed sores, or the loss, or the nursing home is responsible for compensating the family of Miss Johnson because she passed away from the bed sores. The allegations, line by line, of what the nursing home did is laid out in the complaint, in the AKA the lawsuit, as well as what the family or the loved one is requesting in terms of compensation. So that's usually generally what the complaint does, is it makes this factual allegations that comprise a claim and requests a certain amount of money. And that will get filed in the court, and it becomes public record. So that everybody can go down to the courthouse, flip through the papers, and see what the defendant has been accused of. That's generally the first thing. Oftentimes, at least in the state of Georgia, a complaint for nursing home abuse or neglect will require, because it many times the claim will comprise what's called a professional negligence claim, it will require an addendum, an extra piece of paper, an extra document attached to it. And that document is going to be the affidavit or sworn statement of an individual that would be deemed an expert in that field. It's usually a medical doctor or a nurse or an administrator that has competency to speak on the allegations, that will say yay or nay, well, not nay, but yay, that this nursing home was in fact liable for committing a breach of the standard of care, and that breach caused the damage.
And this comes from, there's a Georgia statute that says if you're going to file a suit against any one of these individuals or entities, and it includes everything from attorneys and architects, doctors, or even hospitals themselves, and you're going to allege professional negligence, then you have to get somebody who is an expert in that field to say, I think there's negligence here. I've actually done that before in a legal malpractice case, where I reviewed the case for another attorney and determined that based on my experience, it was legal malpractice. This is a part of tort reform. And to be honest with you, it's not really something that I have an issue with. I mean, I think it's a good idea to have an expert review a case for you and determine.
So that the viewer or the audience is on the same page as you, when you say this is part of a tort reform, what do you mean?
So a tort is anything that is committed between two people and involves negligence. It's different than a breach of a contract, right? So auto accident, medical malpractice, nursing home negligence, anything that has to do with breaching a standard of care. Big business, you know, insurance companies, the far right for sure, have always tried to make it harder and harder for people to sue, and to help these large interest groups like insurance companies, product manufacturers, healthcare facilities, doctors, medical malpractice providers, insurance companies have always tried to protect them, and by introducing tort reform. And they have suggested all kinds of things, from caps on non-economic damages in medical malpractice cases to caps on punitive damages to, they recently, and they've floated this around before, doing away with medical malpractice completely and having issues taken before a medical review board that decides, you know, what should happen.
And the, I mean, not to disparage those companies, those insurance companies, the far right, the rationale behind pursuing those statutory reforms, the tort reforms, is for, allegedly, the purpose is to reduce the level of unmeritorious claims, which cost the civil justice system and these companies lots of money. Obviously, we have our views on whether or not that's an actual problem or not, but that's the legitimate concern that is the rationale behind the promulgation of these proposed bills and statutes.
And I think that,
and so, and to, but to, but get back to my original question.
Okay.
This, the reason why the affidavit is required, the sworn statement by the expert, yeah, is another component of, well, if they weren't required, then more non-meritorious claims would be brought. So having an affidavit is an extra kind of speed bump to prevent ridiculous claims.
And I think it's, like, I actually think it's good, being somebody who is actually on that list that require you provide an expert opinion, I think it's good, because it literally, in Georgia, the pleading requirements are so liberal that you could take one piece of paper and say, I sue nursing home, if you didn't have this affidavit requirement, and anybody could file it, and nursing homes would just face constant lawsuits.
Yeah, I agree with that from just a general civil justice standpoint. I mean, like, when I was an intern, one of my first jobs as an intern was at the law firm, we dealt with prisoners making claims, and it's a good thing the pleading requirement is very loose, because, I mean, obviously they need justice as well, and, you know, sure, I would see stuff written on it with crayon. I'm serious, pieces of paper. But anyway, so that's right. So that's the complaint, which in a professional malpractice case, professional negligence case, now, has to have an affidavit.
And one then, more thing about this, okay,
right.
Before we move on,
sure,
is that it is not always a requirement that you have to have an affidavit if you're suing in these cases, if you're alleging simple negligence. You're not alleging professional negligence.
Yeah, without getting into too much detail on that.
But it's, there are such it's such a tricky distinction.
So if you're out there and your loved one wants to sue, it's a good idea that they seek out an attorney.
An attorney, especially... we don't use the term specialized in Georgia, but especially
the focuses,
familiar, focuses. The focuses on nursing home neglect.
Right. But anyway, so that's one of the millions of reasons why you want to seek out a competent attorney. But the nursing home will have, depending on what state you're in, the nursing home will have a certain amount of time to officially respond. That also gets filed with the court. In Georgia, it's 30 days. And they'll file a response, which is generally called an answer, or they'll be able to, depending on the facts of the case, they'll file a motion, which is called a motion to dismiss. But anyway, they're going to respond to the allegations in one way or the other. They're either going to say pound sand, or they're going to respond and say, maybe this happened, but we're not, you know, responsible for the damages, blah, blah, blah. They're going to respond in some way or another. Which after that, then you have, basically, you've given a statement to the court, they've given a statement to the court, and then generally what happens is you have a certain amount of time, and we hear this in TV shows and such, but you have a certain amount of time for what's called discovery. Discovery is the process by which both parties provide documents, statements, admissions, evidence, and testimony that highlights the facts of the case. So typically it comes in two parts. The first part is going to be written discovery. Written discovery is where the both sides will send out written questions called interrogatories that need to be answered. So, for example, state the name of any witnesses to Ms. Johnson's fall, or provide to me all the insurance policies that may cover Ms. Johnson's injury. Things of that nature, written statements that have to be answered, generally under oath, that will highlight certain facts and certain allegations and make litigation a little smoother because everybody knows where they're coming from. In the civil justice system, from just a general standpoint, there is true advocacy in the sense of it's an adversarial system, meaning that, you know, one side is trying to destroy the other side. But at the end of the day, the system is made to where there should not be any surprises at trial. So discovery is where everybody is required by law to lay everything out that they have on the table.
Yeah.
It's a system by which, you know, you're not allowed to lie. You're not allowed to withhold things. You're not allowed to hide things, if particularly if it's going to be used at trial. So it's not a gotcha type of situation. Sometimes criminal justice can be that way.
It is not supposed to be that way at all.
But it happens. But yeah. In civil justice, that absolutely is not the purpose. The purpose is, you show me what you got, I'll show you what I got, and then we'll just let the jury decide how this thing works out. So discovery works in two components. You've got the written component where you're asking questions, or you say, give me all these documents. Give me all the your staffing records for the past 2 years, for example.
Who are the CNAs that were on duty the night this happened? What are their names? I would like to speak with them.
Right. And that's the thing, is like, we get questions before we file a lawsuit from our clients that say, hey, ask them the name of the CNA and we can't, because they're not obligated to under the law to help us in any way. Only until after the lawsuit is filed, generally, are nursing homes required to provide the information that we're seeking. That's why a lawsuit can be very eye-opening and shed the light on situations, because people are not obligated to provide anybody anything unless they have been ordered by the court. And that's what happens in litigation, is the court is saying, it's an open order saying you have to respond to discovery. So that's important, because during litigation, oftentimes, almost every time, you're going to find out things about the nursing home that you did not know before you filed the lawsuit, for that exact reason. The other component, aside from getting answers under oath on paper, or getting documents, or getting physical evidence, or even access to the nursing home to look around, is the component of discovery called depositions. Depositions is where you, and I say you, I mean the attorney that is representing you, if you're, or your loved one, orders an individual from the nursing home, or anybody, to come to an office somewhere, sit down at a table across from them, and answer questions under oath. And those questions are taken down by a stenographer. And depending on the type of deposition, they can often be used in court later on at trial. So, for example, like, was it light green or red? At the deposition, they say green, but they say red at court. You take out the deposition transcript, things like that. But the deposition generally is good for several reasons. The first reason is that, again, for the purposes of getting to the facts, what is the nursing home staff member, what's the CNA think about what happened? What do they say happened? Mm-hmm. That's important. You want to know that, right? And you probably didn't know that beforehand. The second component is that you want to lock in what their opinion is, because if it changes, then you can highlight that. But also, so from a standpoint of just finding out what happened, from the second standpoint of, you know, with an eye towards locking in testimony and locking in positions. Discovery in professional malpractice cases and kind of complicated negligence cases can go on for quite a long time. The minimum usually is going to be 6 months. We've had discovery go on for 18 months in some cases. Depends on what judge. So I feel like some judges don't mess around with discovery too much. Some judges are say, you know, y'all need to get on the stick.
And it depends on if it's in a state, as in the state of Georgia, or federal court.
Yeah.
Federal judges are...
U.S. court. Yeah.
U.S. court.
So, so the discovery goes on for a certain amount of time, and then so you're either bolstering your claim or maybe you're wanting to settle your claim depending on what facts are coming out. Then what happens is that you have a certain amount of time for what is called motions practice. Motions practice, there's, and again, this actually goes back to tort reform. This is why most plaintiff's attorneys don't agree that there is a problem with ridiculous claims, because there's so many steps along the way that weed out bad cases. The first step, again, is the affidavit component. The second step is the nursing home was within its rights to, rather than respond with an answer, meaning we deny or admit allegations, their answer can say your claim does not have merit at all based on the laws of the state of Georgia. So that's the second or third speed bump for crazy claims. Another speed bump is motions practice, where the nursing home can say, we have looked at everything that you have. We've provided you everything that we have. And even on your best day, even if looked at in a light that is most favorable to the plaintiff, to the person, the resident that was injured, you cannot bring a claim. That's a process that happens after discovery has concluded. And sometimes cases get thrown out at that point. A jury will never hear it because the claim has failed as a matter of law in some component. The facts did not compute to...
That no reasonable jury could decide in the plaintiff's favor.
Correct. So that motions practice can last for months, because generally you file by a certain deadline, and generally there are scheduling orders and it depends on what judge you have, it depends on what court you're in, but generally that can last several months. Then you get put on a trial calendar, and so sometimes if there's lots of witnesses and the issues are complicated, it'll be specially set, but we all hope for that, but sometimes, most of the time, it doesn't happen, and that could take several months, and then you have your trial, and trial is all hands on deck for lawyers,
and you will, just as a side note, you will almost never get to go to trial your first time on a trial calendar.
You're 100. I think we've been 160th on a calendar before.
Yeah, so you're not going.
Yeah,
you're not going unless you're between 1 and 4, just because.
And just so that you understand what we're talking about, you'll get the letter, or the attorney gets the letter in the mail that says, here are all the cases that could potentially be called during a certain period. So the periods can be 3 days, a week, 2 weeks, or a month, meaning that anytime during that 1 day, week, month long period, you could be called and have to come in and state your claim and have trial. And it's called a calendar. And and in Georgia it goes chronologically. So theoretically, the first case that was filed that's on that calendar
the
goes
oldest
first.
Case.
The oldest case. That's what I mean. Yeah. The oldest case, and so on and so forth. But you never know.
And cases will settle, and that'll bump you up.
Yeah.
But again, if you're, 100th on a calendar,
yeah,
you're not going.
Yeah. So there's that process in actually getting on the calendar to go to trial. And then your trials itself, depending on the complexity of the case, generally professional malpractice cases can last from 2 or 3 days to 2 or 3 weeks. It's rare to be 3 weeks, but that can happen depending on the level of complexity with the injury and the level of complexity with the arguments on what caused the injury. So, for example, whether or not a nursing home resident,
Have a lot of comorbidities,
or there was a complication with the previous surgery.
Yeah,
things where there's not an exact A to B. From injury to death, from the acts or omissions of the nursing home. Okay, so we've gone through trial now. Congratulations. So then you have what's called, you can have post-trial motions, which is another speed bump towards.
And let's give people a kind of perspective here on what we're talking about. Let's say that you filed this lawsuit January 1st of 2017. You're now looking at where we are. You're now looking at probably January. You're looking at spring of 2018. On a lucky,
if you're lucky.
Assuming that you
in
went
the state the of
first,
Georgia.
Yeah, on the assuming that you went on the first calendar that you got on.
Yeah.
The reality is you're probably looking at fall
of 2019.
Yeah.
So
those of you that are familiar with all these TV dramas like The Good Wife or Law and Order, where somebody files a lawsuit and that same episode they're in court, the reality is that the time it takes you to actually get to trial from filing a lawsuit is two or three seasons.
The characters need to be like fatter, have longer
beards.
Yeah, it
would be two or three seasons.
Yeah, man, like it doesn't make any sense.
No.
Okay, so after the post-trial motions, then generally you have to deal with appeals. An appeal is not just we didn't like the verdict, which is a common misconception among lay people. An appeal is where the plaintiff or the defendant is saying a decision by the judge as a matter of how the law should be read was incorrect and it affected the outcome of the verdict. It affected the outcome of the trial. So, for example, whether or not an expert is qualified to provide testimony, which is a call made by the judge. If the judge says, you know what, that expert is qualified, but they're a quack, then what happens is that it provides the basis for an appeal. And it goes up on appeal. And when I say go up on appeal, that means that an appellate, which is called appellate court, will hear that argument. Hey, listen, the trial judge let this expert quack provide an opinion and he's not qualified. And the court of opinion will say, yes, he is, or no, he's not. And then the party, depending on the outcome of the appeal, can appeal that decision. And that can go up again. And if you're in state court, not to bore everybody, but generally if you're in state court, there's generally one level of court of appeals in your state. And then there's going to be the next level of appeals is going to be the Supreme Court of the state. That's generally how that works. And if you don't like that, good luck, because then your next appeal is going to be to the Supreme Court of the United States. That's the way you're going to go in a state trial. In a federal trial where you're in a U.S. court, your first round of appeals is going to be to whatever circuit you're in. So, for example, we are in the 11th Circuit in Georgia. So, from an appeal from a U.S. district court in the state of Georgia is going to be heard by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals here in Atlanta, Georgia. If you don't like that, tough luck, because you're going to have to appeal to the Supreme Court from there.
And these cases don't normally involve novel issues that the higher courts are going to listen to.
Correct. Generally,
the higher courts isn't like the Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court of the United States very rarely hears these issues. The buck is probably going to stop with your state's Court of Appeals or your state Supreme Court, which are more faster acting than the United States Supreme Court.
Although, please note that because I have worked on a couple of appeals in Georgia, the Court of Appeals in Georgia is probably one of the busiest in the nation.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, and it can take. I mean, I've worked on an appeal before that is still going on. Actually, has been going on for about three and a half years.
And so that's a good point. That was actually going to be my point, is that the appeals process can be anywhere between 6 months and a couple years. And if it goes to multiple appellate courts, then just add another year or two onto that.
Now, understand something here, that there is an incentive for the defendant to pay the verdict or to settle with you rather than do that, because the juice is running on that.
When you say the juice is running, to those of us that are not professional gamblers or degenerates,
interest,
what does that mean?
Interest is running on that verdict. So if you have a verdict that is substantial, I think that they're the most recent substantial verdict that I saw in Fulton County that was being appealed or potentially appealed was a $30 million auto accident case.
Wow.
You can imagine that $30 million in the interest on that is going to be a hefty, hefty fine against that nursing
home. To make an appeal gratuitously. They better... Their cost-benefit analysis, they need to make sure they're on the right page. Do you remember the movie Juice had Tupac?
Oh, I think so. I don't remember what it was about, though.
I want to say that... And it had Samuel L. Jackson in it. A character in it, I can't remember, but he, whatever character did this, and I think it might have been Tupac, his character would play with a razor in his mouth.
Uh-huh.
And I think that he actually did it. Like, he learned to do it. And I thought that was really interesting and extremely dangerous.
I would never do that.
Yeah, he would flip it around with his tongue. Like, you know how some people have toothpicks? Would do it with a razor. Like, you have a razor sticking out of his mouth and toss it around his mouth. But, you know, pour some out for Tupac.
Yeah.
And speaking of things or persons that have been lost to us, now we must say goodbye to this podcast.
I think that may be the worst ending segue we've had so far.
You think so?
Yeah. You could have said, and speaking of, I ain't mad at you that it's time for you to go, and we'll see you next time.
That would have been good, too.
Yeah.
Let's see. I could have done something about a hologram. Now it's time for this hologram to fade.
Yeah, but that's so obscure. Anyway.
Okay.
Let's just end this. Let's shoot this puppy and get it over with.
Yeah. Let's shoot this rapper.
Yeah.
So that concludes this episode of the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast, Painfully. This is, in fact, a video podcast, meaning that you can download the audio on Stitcher or iTunes. Subscribe to us there. Leave us reviews. Leave us glowing reviews, unless you're a Tupac fan. And then you can also...
We have offended you somehow.
Yeah. Or you can watch us on our website, nursinghomeabusepodcast.com, or our YouTube channel. New episodes are available every Monday morning. We thank you for joining us this episode, and we will see you next time.
See you next time.
Thanks for tuning in to the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. Please be sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, and feel free to leave us some feedback. And for more information about the topics discussed in this episode, check out the show website, nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. That's nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. See you next time.